Welcome to Nutmeg Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk. Tony Henry was the general manager of WAPJ during the early years of the station, when WAPJ moved from their space at the Nutmeg Ballet Conservatory to its new home on Water Street in downtown Torrington. Henry has been a consistent voice for the station and continues to provide quality entertainment on the air. He will be retiring in February of 2018. So we hope you enjoy our chat with Tony Henry here on Nutmeg Chatter. Welcome to Nutmeg Chatter, Tony Henry.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you. You have a long and storied history with WAPJ. Being a general manager, that is a huge responsibility, correct?
It was a labor of love. I spent more time here than I did at home, and my wife was always complaining in a nice way. But it was a passion. I mean, radio is a passion to me. I just love it. I think it's the best media available. I'd rather have radio than TV, really.
Now, as the listeners can already hear, you have a fantastic voice for the radio. I mean, the dulcet tones of Tony Henry, as it were, is perfect for the airwaves. So I can see why that would be of interest to the listeners. But where was your passion? Where did your passion for radio come from?
As a child, living in rural Ireland, we obviously no TV. But we had radio, and they had radio plays. I listened to everything from Shakespeare to Chekhov on Monday evenings, Wednesday evenings, and there was storytelling, and it was enthralling. I mean, it just your imagination just went wild listening to radio, and I just developed a love for that, and then, you know, never thought anything about it until I joined the service, the Royal Air Force in England, which, you know, was unusual for an Irish guy, but I did it.
Okay.
And, you know, there was Forces Radio there. And one of my friends, Brian Bridle, was the station manager at Radio 301, which is a British Forces network. And I used to go down there and just make coffee for the guys and sit in the green room and entertain guests and, you know, play around in the studio off air. And then, you know, one evening at 6 o'clock, the regular DJ, Andy T, I'll always remember, was a little late. So, you know, Brian said to me, hey, why don't you just go in and set up for the program? When he comes in, he'll take over. And, you know, I went in and I had everything set up, and I was waiting for the sign from the guy in the other studio to start. And I was sweating because Andy hadn't arrived. Little did I know I was being set up. This was my maiden voyage. And my first song was Petula Clark, Downtown, which I played at 33 instead of 45. And immediately just changed it down and didn't lose my cool. And that was my initiation into radio. It was a commie plot.
That's amazing. So you had that amazing history prior to even coming to WAPJ. How long did you do radio?
I was 5 years on that, and I ended up being the station manager there. And then my time was up in the service, and I came home. And at a later stage, there was a community radio station in a nearby town, Castlebar Community Radio Station, and I went in there and just started at the bottom. Then the afternoon guy left, and I got the afternoon gig, and I became friends with the lead guitarist in a classic rock band, and we decided to do a satirical political classic rock show. Now, in Ireland, you have a lot more leeway in how you treat politicians and religion and anything else. I mean, we had
really
a ball. But we had to use different names. We couldn't use our own name. So we were the Reverend Rock and Brother Leroy. And we had to record it and it had to be played over to the attorneys before it went out over the air. But we got a cult following because we basically ripped every politician and priest when they did something wrong. And I mean, we were not politically correct.
Sure. But in that, you're making an indelible mark in the into the community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they loved us. I mean, it's, you know, I'm hoping to hook up with Frank again when I get home. Maybe he will resurrect the Power Hour, even though it was a two-hour show. But that was just our sense of humor.
The Power Hour, but it was two hours.
Two-hour show, yeah.
Well, that's a lot of power right there. But you also enacted a lot of power just in being able to use your voice to comment on the things that were going on in the community and to take people down a peg who may have needed to, I guess, in that particular time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, politicians, you know, absolute power corrupts.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we did one little segment on people getting little brown paper bags shoved in under their door and then doing favors. So we approached that as a gentleman called Xerox, who was from Uranus. They pronounced it Uranus at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he crash-landed his spacecraft in the car park of Dunn's Stores, which is the Irish equivalent of Walmart, but he was looking for a politician to get favors done under the counter. And we traced his journey round the town until he came and knocked at the door at Mr. Flynn, who was, and Mr. Flynn took care of everything.
Did you get any feedback at that time? Of course, there's no social media. There's no Facebook, no Twitter. No, so how does one get the feedback either from the community who loves it or the politicians who may not share the same love of the show?
One or two politicians tried to get us taken off the air, but Martin Waters, who owned the radio station, after the attorneys would give us a slap on the wrist, Martin would take us aside and say, yeah, keep going, keep going, because the ratings were up. And, I mean, we even attacked a rival radio station owner because he had been suspected of sexual harassment.
Hmm.
And we took him to task over that.
Absolutely.
You know, through comedy, you know.
Yeah.
And it worked. You know, he ended up apologizing to person involved. But it was all, you know, it was just, I mean, I wouldn't get home on Friday. I would go into work on Friday morning at about 7 o'clock. I wouldn't get home until 11 at nighttime. And that was all radio work. Was doing outselling commercials, selling ideas for commercials, then going back into the production studio, working on the script, working on the background, the special effects. And then what we would do was we would play a cut of the commercial over the air live, and the customer would say, okay, I like it, or no, can you do this, can you do that? And it saved a lot of time. And it was great. I enjoyed it.
Wow. So from the Royal Air Force Radio to building a cult following on a provocative show in local Irish politics and in the community, when did you do any radio, or when did you first start radio here in Connecticut?
Well, we arrived in Torrington in 1999, and my daughter, Siobhan, went to middle school, and for some reason they had a tour of downtown, and they took her in to the basement of the Nutmeg,
yeah.
And she met the station manager, and she said, well, my daddy had his own show in Ireland. And about, you know, 2 hours later, I get a call from then manager Mickey Beck, and he came down and we talked, and he said, when can you start? And I said, well, I'm not doing anything this evening. So I started a classic rock show at 4 o'clock that evening, and I did from 4 to 7. And then when I got back from vacation, I used to finish work at 3:15 in Watertown, race up Route 8, get into the studio with about 2 minutes to spare and do a three-hour show and then go home. And I loved it.
If the weather works with you, that
weather and traffic was fine. And Then we, like, you know, we, it was terrible. They, you know, the Warner, through whatever means, couldn't continue with the radio station, so it kind of shut down temporarily. And when it opened up here, Dr. Temkin called me, and I had done a business plan out on my vision of what the radio station should be, and he asked me would I like to take it over, and I jumped at the chance.
That's incredible. So what was, you had a business plan, so it wasn't just simply, this is something I can do. You actually had a vision for where you'd like to see the radio station go towards.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the future. I wanted to go back to old-time radio, where you could do, you know, the shadow, bring the shadow back, bring storytelling back. I had talked to a local playwright, and he had written about 7 one-act plays that we could have broadcast. And actually, we did a, we did 3 parts of a 4-part whodunit based on 1940s radio with a gentleman, a New York scriptwriter. I can't remember his name. John was his first name. And it worked out well for the first 2, but a lot of the actors were from the Norwalk area, and they couldn't make it up all the time, and we just could not get enough interest here. But, I mean, we had a ball rehearsing in there, even though he was a taskmaster. I mean, you don't know what it's like rehearsing in front of the guy that that actually wrote the script. it was an eye-opener, but again, a pleasure eye-opener with one of the hosts of the morning show, Barry Soucy, very, very good. I mean, a natural radio actor. There were the other people, I can't. My wife took a part in it. But it was great. I mean, it was.
I would love to see that. I'm a fan of the old time radio, the Jack Benny, the Shadow, of course.
You know,
Fibber McGee and Molly, if you will. I mean, all of the classics. It would be amazing to actually have that renaissance again. Perhaps not every single show be that way, but certainly to have a show.
Yeah,
two.
I mean,
would be amazing.
You know, a mix. Yeah. And then I just started on sport. I said, hold on, we got a high school here. We got baseball, soccer, football. So I did I talked to the local athletic director, and we started doing basketball games and football games. And then I met this guy called John Eustace, who was running the Tour of Connecticut, a 3-day cycle race. And with, you know, 2.5 yards of wire and a couple of cell phones, I got guys out in 5 different areas covering 2 days of the race, and we covered the final stage here in town. I mean, a small little radio station running on a shoestring, and we were able to pull it off.
That's incredible. I think it's a perfect way to end the first segment of Nutmeg Chatter. When we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the early successes of WAPJ under your leadership. So we're going to be back in just a few moments here with Tony Henry on Nutmeg Chatter. Tony Henry. In the first segment, we learned about the personal history as it relates to radio of Tony Henry, how he began his radio career at working for the RAF, for the Royal Air Force Radio, and then created a cult following at a radio station in Ireland. He eventually, when he came to Torrington, he was invited, and in one phone call, was able to come into the station and start a radio show on that particular day. Eventually, he became the station manager, a role he's had previously at other stations. And he had a vision for what WAPJ could become. As we ended the last segment, we learned about the race that with the use of cell phones, using technology, you're able to create a successful broadcast that captured the start, finish of a race.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. Art Benedict and Luke Hutchison were unbelievable. I mean, Art has been here. Art has been at WAPJ, I think, since the start. He was up at UConn. Mm-hmm. And Luke worked with me down in Watertown, and a terrific sports mind. And they just jumped right into it. Yeah. And I mean, we covered when the local team went in and won the state championship. I mean, we did that live, and it was unheard of for a small community radio station, would run by volunteers,
right,
could do such a thing. But you know, nothing seemed to be impossible.
Why was that the case? Why do you think nothing seemed to be impossible?
I don't know. There was a great buzz around the place. I mean, if I wanted, like, Barry Soucy was a great, you know, great guy. Still is. I mean, Barry and I would go round the town on cold days, freezing winter days, knocking on doors, looking for money, looking for sponsorship.
Wow.
And you know, there are a few places you'd go in and they would know who you were, what you were looking for, and they would freeze you out for 10 minutes, and we would wait them until they finally had to come up and ask. And there was just a buzz. I mean, the enthusiasm from everybody. I mean, it was tremendous. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, John Ramsey at the time was a resource. John would kind of calm me down because I was over-enthusiastic. I mean, I would have worked. You know, I couldn't wait when I was in my job. You know, instead of concentrating, I was working on program ideas. Mm. And John was a great leveler, you know, and talked about the ins and outs of things. And we had meeting. I mean, communication, I thought, was great. We had regular meetings and, you know, aired our grievances out. And I was always looking for talent. Anytime I heard a voice, I would tap them on the shoulder and say, you know, did you ever think of coming down doing some radio? Because a lot of people don't even know that they have radio voices.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard work. There were weekends, you know, you'd be exhausted because I was here. Sometimes I would come in and do a show at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I would be out fundraising in the afternoon. And then we might have somewhere to a remote broadcast that night. You know, we started filming, I was going to say. We started doing the Memorial Day parade.
Yes.
And that was, again, with very, very limited equipment. But I don't know, nothing seemed to be too big for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to cover the aspect of the live broadcast that are done remotely. So the remote broadcast. I want to get to that section, but before I don't want to lose the idea that what you just described of when you in the early days of fundraising, of knocking on doors literally to try to fundraise. Nowadays, there's different mechanisms, and of course there's a time frame where there might be a pledge drive of sorts.
Yeah.
But at the time that you were doing it, there was nothing like that.
No, there was no. I mean, we had no idea. I mean, Dr. Temkin, God bless him, I mean, poured heart and soul and a lot of money mm-hmm. into the radio station. And we had, you know, a few of our stalwart sponsors who were still with us. But we needed more.
Right.
And a lot of people in town didn't even know that there was a radio station. They thought that the local radio stations were commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And because one of the local radio stations still used Torrington in their call sign, which was obviously legal, but a little bit misleading. And I talked to Mayor Owen Quinn, when I saw him appearing on another radio station that said they were based in Torrington, and I said to him, Mr. Mayor, you know, we are the only Torrington radio station.
Right here on Water Street.
Right here on Water Street. You know, and we just got, you know, I was just looking for ideas. How can we get out there in front of the public and make them aware of the fact that there is a radio station?
Right.
So we would cover the New Year's Eve. We had the, I don't know if they still do it or not, but they would have an alcohol-free New Year's Eve program down at the Armory.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was from 8 to 11 and family-friendly. So we would cover that live and help around, and we had banners all over the place. I even sent a friend of mine, Chris Zerzicki, with his cell phone running the Torrington road race. Wasn't that successful. He would stop every so often and give an account of what was happening, but after 3 or 4 miles, he was out of breath. But, you know, it was, I mean, it got us out there, you know.
Right.
And we had, I mean, I would call the Connecticut School of Broadcasting to beg, borrow, or steal equipment.
And just as a programming reminder, everyone is a volunteer. So all of the funds do go to the station's basic needs of, you know, the rent of the equipment, upkeep, maintenance of the mm-hmm. of the equipment. Every person is working as a volunteer.
Yes. I mean, from John, you know, nowadays from John Ramsey and Mark Channon down to, we're all on the same level.
We're all volunteers, but right.
Yeah, nobody takes a cent right. out of it. And, you know, I think we do a far better job than commercial radio people who are paid a lot more than we are, which is nothing. You know, the people that come in here have a passion for it. You have to have a passion.
Right.
You know, to get in there and we're all about communication too. I mean, you know, I think Tom Petty's song, the late Tom Petty's song, The Last DJ, just sums everything up about the DJ who played what he wanted to play and says what he wanted to say. You know, maybe political correctness has stunted our growth a little bit, but you know, when you go on some of the radio stations, you listen to them, and all you hear is, well, for a list of last songs played, check our website. And then it's into a commercial, and then it's into music. There's no communication between the listener and the broadcaster. Mm-hmm. And I find that very, very important. I mean, you get a connection. And if you can tell a story about the band, or about the song, or about something that happened to you, I've used that a lot, and I get return on that, because I get people coming in and saying, well, listen, you know that song you played? Well, I remember, and you get a story out of it. And it's, you know, it's communicating. Like, as little as last Saturday, our Mississippi Mudcat and Art Benedict and I, we covered a fundraiser down at the Eagles Club for the Torrington Soup Kitchen. And lo and behold, a lot of my listeners came in. I'd never seen them. But they wanted to come in and put a face behind the voice.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, I'm to the right to the point. I said, you know, well, what do you like about my show? And they said, well, you're talking to me. You are talking to me. You're telling me the story. You're telling me about the band and about where you were. And that's, I think that they like that personal approach.
Absolutely. We're going to take our second break. We come back, we're going to talk about that personal approach that you have, whether that was something that was innate or something that you learned. Who are some of the broadcasters that you learned from, and how do you try to assist the next generation of broadcasters? So we're going to be back in just a few moments here with Tony Henry on Nutmeg Chatter. So we'll just take a break. Actually, we can just continue right now.
That's fine.
Welcome back to Nutmeg Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk here at WEPJ Torrington Community Radio. I'm with Tony Henry, and we're talking about the history of WEPJ, talking about the history of Tony Henry at WEPJ. And Tony had just related a story of the folks who he had met at the Eagles Club. There was a fundraiser, and I happened to watch that live on Facebook, thanks to our social manager, media manager, Alicia, who was posting some information on Facebook, along with, I believe, along with Darcy, was running
yes,
the board.
She did some Facebook. Yeah.
So she did some Facebook Live right before you guys went live. So that was fantastic. I enjoyed listening to it. But you had described how there is a connection. You build a connection between yourself and the audience. You're talking to people. You're talking and talking with people. You're having a dialogue, even if you're the one in front of the mic. Is that a technique, and is that a something that is innate for you, or is that a skill that you learned?
I think it's, without being pompous, I think it was a natural ability that I had, or I have. But early on, when I was in RAF Wadisham, that was the base I was in, my idol at the time, there were two idols. Stuart Henry was on a radio station called Radio Luxembourg. It was one of the first legal commercial radio stations in Europe that played pop music. And he had a great voice, and he talked. I felt he talked to me. Then the legendary BBC DJ John Peel lived locally in near Wadisham, and a friend of his, I just happened to meet an acquaintance of his, and I had changed my name. I wasn't using Tony Henry. I was using Tony Stewart. And I was basing myself on John Peel. Now, John Peel had a monotone voice. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to my show. The next song coming up is Led Zeppelin. I talked to Robert Plant last week, and he had a headache. And I was trying to be John Peel.
That was his style.
It was
a recognizable style. Yeah.
And this other John I met, we were in the Fox Hotel in Stowmarket having a beer. And he said, but you're not John Peel. You're Tony Henry. So take it from there. And and then I did. And we had Brian Bridle, gave me a spot for a classic rock show. And like classic rock at the time, and maybe still so, it's a lot like classical music. You kind of have to explain and be a little bit knowledgeable about, why Yes is a great band and they're all classically trained, as distinct from Thin Lizzy, who are just a garage band who made it big and had some great music and great guitarists. So I read a lot about them, and I would explain, this is Steve Howe, an excellent classically trained guitarist, and Rick Wakeman is a keyboard player, and is a consummate classical fan. And I found myself telling people, and I enjoyed it. And I started another program on my own called The Choice Is Yours. And our base was a fighter base, plus there were some special forces airborne. I was airborne. We were always in flux. There were different people there. So I said, let me do this program. And I used to bring pilots in and say, okay, you pick six songs about various stages of your life, and let's talk about how you became a pilot.
An interesting idea, yeah.
And it was a very, some of it was eye-opening. I remember Wing Commander John Welcome, who was the squadron commander of 29th Squadron, and I interviewed himself and his wife, and I got more information than I really thought about. They had a very open marriage. They never went on vacation together, but they always came back to each other. And they were, I was kind of like Ralph Cramden going, hamana, 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 how do I get out of this gracefully? But they put me at ease. But it was a great program, and it was very easy to do, because, servicemen love to talk about their experiences.
Sure, and that's a great idea of having the individual share six songs that are, informative in terms of their life story, and then through that you can learn a great deal. That's fantastic. In terms of, and we're going to come back to that, but in terms of your own personal history and your own skill, you then became the general manager. Were you able to, take that skill and knowledge, even if it was innate for you, and then be able to share it with the new generation of broadcasters?
Yeah, because I give, When I talked to Dr. Temkin, and I said, you know, I am not going to be an in-your-face type of manager. Mm-hmm. I want people to be able to express themselves. And anyone that came in, I said, you know, you produce, you present your show. But I want to know what it's about, and there are certain parameters, because we are obviously a community-based radio station.
Yes.
We have to be cognizant of the fact that we have people that are 6 and people who are 60 listening to it.
Right.
And by and large, 99.99% of the people were very, very open to, you know, to suggestions, and they were grateful to the fact that I wasn't looking over their shoulder saying, well, you know, do it this way, you know, do it that way. I didn't want to be a teacher. I wanted people, you know, go on the air, warts and all. I mean, get it out of your system and become your own person, like I was told to do. And, you know, a lot of people come in. Some people just froze in front of the mic and just, they were just too nervous. Other people, you know, sometimes they'd be verbose, so you'd have to say, listen, you know, less is more. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you have to let the music talk for you. And I was able to, you know, I was able to get a few talk shows going. I did one myself with Chris Zizicki, a friend of mine. We had Midweek with Tony Henry. And
tell me about that. Tell me
well,
about
Well, we were an equal opportunity. We just took, it was around the time that Governor John Rowland was having his problems, or starting to have his problems. And, you know, we read the paper, and Chris was a great, you know, I was kind of, I took the more center right and he took center left. So we had opposing approaches, but basically the same solution, but we'd mm-hmm. approach it from different directions. And it was fun. We did it for about a year and a half, and then our schedules just got too much. And
do you think that type of talk radio format could work again on WAPJ?
Well, you know, personally, I think it could. You know, as I said, you have to be aware of that you are a small town radio station, and that there are a lot of politicians on both sides that do tremendous work. So I, you know, and do you want to be bluntly honest? Is it good?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I mean, and I don't want to, you know, interfere with what John and Mark would even plan. I'm sure if the right people came along, yes, it. I think we should have. The politicians, they should be answerable to us, and they shouldn't be afraid to come in and sit down and answer a few questions.
Even if the show isn't of the same format as the one in Ireland, Father, I'm sorry, what was your pseudonym? Father?
Reverend Rock.
Reverend Rock, yeah. Exactly.
In Ireland, I mean, as people who have seen the British Parliament system and how they can get up and argue with each other, and it's not as civilized, quote-unquote, as Congress is, although I don't know how I can call Congress civilized, but there is that freedom, and politicians, when they come into a radio station in Ireland, they know that they can get a question out of left field, and they better be prepared to answer. And the political programs that were on CRCFM in Castlebar, I mean, we had great political reporters, very knowledgeable. And I saw a lot of sweating and squirming politicians around that table during election time. I think it's different over here. It's you got to be a little bit more careful, seeing as you are a community radio, and you depend on the community for its funds. The difference between community radio in Ireland and over here is you can sell commercials. You can be a fully commercial radio station in Ireland and still be a community radio.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's still a non-profit. Everything is plowed back in, but
right.
you can be self-sufficient.
Okay.
Now, you can still, you know, you still go to the big companies for sponsorship, but by and large, you sold commercials. You know, you sold Christmas greetings. Of course, once you got one bar doing it, you got 50, every bar and restaurant in the town, because they didn't want to be.
They didn't want to be the ones left out.
Yeah, and I did that on 2 years here successfully for Thanksgiving and Christmas. I just went around with a Sony Walkman and walked in and said, hey, this is free, just here. Just tell your listeners.
That's a nice idea. Yeah.
And, you know, it was, you had to think on your feet, be innovative, you know, some things fell flat in their face. You know, some radio programs didn't work. I tried some classical programs, but I didn't have anybody that was knowledgeable enough in classic. And that's one of the few genres of music. You really have to know your music to be able to present a show.
That makes sense. And to know what's excellent and what's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The difference between excellent and
you know, what's a movement? What's a concerto? What's,
sure.
You know, it's, so some of those kind of died. But we got we had a good mix of music, and there was a constant flow of people. People would come in and have programs, but then through work, or you know, some people that come in, actually they were unemployed. They started an afternoon radio program, and then they'd find that job, and then,
and good for them. That's great.
You know, I mean,
it
is great. And then you had to find, you know, alternative sections for them, and we had, you know, I had John. I used to pester John, poor old John Ramsey. He had come in here. He'd be drilling holes in the wall because I had a friend whose son played in the band, and he was talking about live music. So we started a show with bringing in teenagers and having rock bands in here, and this young John, again his name escapes me, interviewed them, and it was successful. But then we kind of ran out of bands, and we were regurgitating the same bands all the time. But again, the idea was there, and it's still used in like Barry on the morning show sometimes has people come in, and
Darcy on the hot spot.
Darcy, and I think Brian. Yeah, no, Brian doesn't use it. Brian, no. There's a few other programmers I think that bring in periodically some live music. You know, the sky is the limit in this, because it's radio is such a great medium.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to come back in just a few moments. We're going to talk about being a general manager. What are some things that people don't think of, or what would people be surprised of for a general manager to do for WAPJ or for any radio station? And we're going to talk about the remotes. We're going to talk about the remote recordings or remote broadcasting. What are some of the fun moments, fun memories of WAPJ that way? So we're going to be back in just a few moments with Tony Henry here on Nutmeg Chatter. Welcome back to Nutmeg Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk. Here in studio is Tony Henry. We're talking about some fond memories of WAPJ. You know, what are some of the interesting facts of being a general manager, or some of the interesting duties of a general manager of a radio station that people wouldn't expect? Because I think for those who aren't familiar with a radio station, their familiarity comes with, if anything, WKRP in Cincinnati, and seeing, say, Andy Travis try to run a station, but it really didn't focus on like the business aspect of things, or it was a comedy show. But what are some of the interesting things about a general manager, what they do?
Well, you know, you have to set up bank accounts, and to protect myself, I would have two people signing every check that I didn't want the feeling that, he's the general manager, he holds all the checkbooks. I mean, anything, you know, you had to be an accountant. Mm-hmm. We had to work out our budget. And again, John Ramsay was tremendous at helping that. The legal aspect of radio, how to educate the presenters on what they could say, what they couldn't say, and to be ready for that on the spot examination by the FCC. And you know, yeah. I get a call at work in Watertown one afternoon from Dr. Temkin. He said, "I need you up at the radio station. There's an inspector from the FCC in." And I, oh
wow.
And I go in flying blind and never. Mm-hmm. But they were very, very nice guys. He said, "Look, we're not here to catch you out. We understand that there are little faux pas every so often, but we're not out to do you damage." He educated me on a lot of the laws.
That's really interesting in a very positive way of being able to have. You know, the FCC be able to advise and explain rather than, you know, find punitive ways of trying to, deal with a community radio station.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he explained things that I didn't know, that, you know, make sure that you do the ID at the top of the hour, but that you have a little play time, 5 minutes either way, and if you have a song that's playing and you go a little bit over, that's okay, but you have to, you know, and it has to be specific. And, you know, what language. And the legalities I left, if I had a problem, I would call Dr. Temkin and his legal department would deal with them, because I wasn't equipped to get into the finer legal details. Technically wise, then, you know, I have no technical ability whatsoever. John Ramsay, you know, John is just excellent. John would come up at a moment's notice and fix what we had, and I would scour the internet for little things, you know, to little pocket things, so we could do outside broadcasts. I think one of the first that I did was with my wife, and I was celebrating something. Abraham Lincoln actually came through this town at one stage.
And with the train, correct?
With the train. So we had a reenactment of that. And I interviewed him, and I interviewed the founder of the Secret Service, Mr. Pinkerton, and Harriet Beecher Stowe. And that lady was tremendous, because when I put a microphone in front of her first thing, she said, "What evil monstrosity is that?" I mean, she was totally in character.
She was there. She was there.
Yeah. And, you know, so I talked to her about, you know, where she came from in Litchfield and where she was living now. And it was a small little $60 piece of equipment that I got on air. I got on the internet, and between my wife and I, we talked. We were walking around town just telling people what we saw, and we came back here. I did a quick edit, and we stuck it out over the air.
That's fantastic. That's kind of like the remote broadcast moment that you kind of improvised and was able to come up with some wonderful radio, wonderful radio memories.
Oh, yeah. Even Mark Twain, I mean, he was in character. Well, they were all in character. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was tremendous. It was a trip down historical memory lane for me, you know, to actually meet these people.
What are some other fond WAPJ memories of you on air? Were there any special Memorial Day parades, or was it the very first one that you were able to do that sticks out for you, or any other type of remote broadcasts that? Because it seems to me that remote broadcasts are very important to you, because it seems to me that some of your mission has always been to get out into the community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was totally immersed in that, because without the community, we don't have a radio station. So yeah. The more that they took ownership in it, the better it was easier it was for us to achieve what we wanted to achieve. I think one of the fondest. Wow, there are a lot.
Yes, it'd be hard to add.
I think when we when Luke Hutchison and I did the basketball game, the state championship, one that Torrington didn't win, but the regular color man couldn't do it. I had never done sports. I had done some rugby in Ireland, but never basketball, and we needed a color man. And I let my excitement get the better of me because it was such an exciting thing, and Luke would have to calm me down. But I remember coming back the next day, I wasn't sure how it was received, and Dr. Temkin said, "Oh," he said, "best show I ever enjoyed. I loved your excitement."
That's great. Because when you have passion for what it is that you're doing, that really translates to the audience, because the audience is a part of that, because that passion is a part of why they listen to it in the first place.
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, there's nothing I wouldn't try and do on radio. I may not be successful at it, but I'll give it a go. I mean, this place, it's going to be tough to leave this place.
When you retire, will you be searching for another community radio station, do you think?
I'm a little bit way ahead of you there. I've already contacted and have been contacted by a newer radio station that's near the town that I live in. They said, "Hey, as soon as you get off the plane, let's talk."
Wow, that's fantastic.
And John has said that if I can, whatever show I do, either put it on whatever format he wants and send it over here, and if he hits a spot, he'll put it on here.
That would be incredible.
So,
do you think that you would, because also a genre that seems to be of interest to you is classic rock. Would you be doing a classic rock show?
I wouldn't presume to go into the new radio station manager and say, "Hey, I'm Tony Henry. I want to do a classic rock show."
Okay.
Yeah. I'm hoping that he would have a spot.
Sure.
I could probably take any music and make it work.
Right.
I mean, classic rock and blues are what I like myself. But, I would try anything. So it doesn't matter the genre. I'm more knowledgeable about classic rock because that's my era.
Right. That's the thing that you feel passionate about.
Yeah. But, I would love to get back into radio drama.
That would be fantastic.
I would love that. I mean, that is, I'm telling you, there's so much.
If you record a radio drama, I would volunteer my spot during that week so we could play it, because I would love to hear that type of performance if that works out. Because, I mean, literally, having that, I think there would be an interest in that, not just from those who enjoyed it from, from the past perspective, but from a new way of experiencing, stories in an audio format. Podcasts now, which is, kind of a version of the radio outside of the airwaves on the internet, can tell stories. But using the radio broadcast format to tell these type of stories, I think there's a need for that. I think there's
a
niche for that.
And we have my daughter did drama up at Torrington High School. They have a very successful drama. I don't know if she's still there or not, but I often thought about involving the high school people and doing plays, and we were like two, I think Mrs. McVeary, I think was the teacher's name, but we were like two ships passing in the night. We just could never get sitting down and planning. We would talk for 5 or 10 minutes and say, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go and sit down," but it was schedules were just there wasn't enough hours in the day. Because she had a busy, she put on two or three musicals and Chekhov plays, and
that's fantastic.
So I would hope if there's somebody from the drama group at the Torrington High School, if they're listening, I'm sure if you contacted John Ramsey and came up with the right plan, I think he'd be open. I'm not going to speak for John. But John is a lover of community radio.
Absolutely. I have one last question for you, although it can take us into different tangents possibly, but it's one last question for you. One of your key ideas in radio was you would ask an individual that you were interviewing for six songs that represented them in different parts of their history. They told their story. So I ask you, Tony Henry, what are six songs that might inform us of your story?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is an Irish folk song called The Irish Soldier Boy. And the story behind that is when I was about 11 years old, I won a competition to spend 6 months in a totally Gaelic-speaking area. And while I was there, my mother was the principal of the local school in my hometown, and there was an Irish radio program called The School Around the Corner. And this comedian would come around and he would take people from the school and put them up on stage, and they'd sing a song or they'd do something, and then he had comedians and stuff like that, and it was a kind of an old-time variety show. So my mother mailed me the words of this Irish soldier boy, and I used to practice it every night, and the lady that owned the house used to, you know, turn on the radio and listen to me singing, although I never knew. She told me this afterwards. And then, you know, my mother came up to visit and she said, look, I cannot have you do the song because it's not fair to the students who are actually still going to the school. I was away in another county learning, improving on my Gaelic. She said, I couldn't do it. So I said, there's a guy called Sean Regan who's going to sing the song.
Oh, wow.
And I think the second song, I can't remember. It's an album. It was an album called by a guy called Blind Lemon Jefferson. He was a 1920s blues artist. And I was home on leave from the Royal Air Force, and I was in Dublin waiting to go to the airport to get my flight out. And I went into this broken down record bookstore, and I'm looking through, and I come across this record. It's an old 78 with two tracks on each side. And I was into blues at the time, and I saw this is Blind Lemon Jefferson. And I went up to the guy and said, how much for this? And it was like, you know, 10 cents. So I couldn't get it out fast enough and gave it to him. And I think I wore that thing out, even though it was an old, hard, it wasn't a vinyl, it was hard plastic.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was the real old 78.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, again, it would be an album, Led Zeppelin Volume 1, the first Led Zeppelin album. Just blew me away. I had come out of all my education was finished in college, and I was an assistant manager at a hotel in Waterford, and I was walking down the street and I heard this strange heavy sound, because it was, I mean, in Ireland, country and western, three chord country and western songs were the thing, and maybe, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Beatles, yeah, or something like that. And in 1969, this appeared, and I went up, and I was looking in the window, and I saw this sepia photograph of four guys, and I heard this song. You know, it was the first song. First song on side one. I went in. And I pestered the guy until he played the whole album, and I bought it.
Oh, wow. And was it popular at that time?
No, nobody knew. The guy that sold me the thing had no idea who Led Zeppelin was. He just had just put it on by accident as I was walking by, and it just happened to catch it. Then I'm going back to the service again. One afternoon, during a radio show, I went into a studio too, and somebody had been listening to classical music, and they had left an album on the turntable, and it was The Planet Suites by Gustav Holst, and I listened to that in its entirety, and I fell in love with it, and I still play it today. even though I'm not a classical music fan.
Really? Yeah. What about that? What about that speech?
I don't know. I turn the lights off in the studio, and I just stand back, and I don't know. It just enveloped me.
Was it just a moment of being at the station and being where you were supposed to be? Moment became this perfect moment?
It was a perfect moment. I was. I was at peace or with myself. Yeah. I mean, everything just came together. And anytime I hear a piece of that music, I got to stop what I'm doing. And then I get mad because it's usually part of a commercial or it's part of a theme song for a television, you know, I mean. But it's that awakened, I won't say a love of classical music, but an appreciation of classical music and how classical music and classic rock are very, very close together, because there's a lot of improvisation. There's a lot of concepts especially with the progressive rock bands like Yes and King Crimson and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I mean, they were all classically trained musicians, so it was an easy thing. And I've seen even heavy metal bands like Metallica doing albums with classical orchestras. Mm-hmm. And when you blend the two together, it's kind of, from my point of view, it's hard to separate them because there is a connection there. I don't know if I have seven songs. I mean,
was it six or seven?
I think it was six. I'm trying to, it was a half-hour show, so it probably would have been, and they would have been 2 or 3 minute songs at the time, so it probably would have been six. But lately there's a song by Beth Hart and Joe Bonamassa. It's a blues song, and if I hear that, I have to stop.
Do you know the name of that off the top of your head?
I'd Rather Go Blind. It's powerful. I mean, I get shivers. Excuse me, listening to it, and it just, like I said, it stops me in my tracks. And those are the ones. I mean, anything by Rory Gallagher, the Irish blues, the late blues guitarist, because I met him personally in Toads and sat down and talked to him, one Irishman to another.
Yeah.
And he allowed me to go up on stage with him and take photographs. And it was a great experience. And, you know, I found out that, okay, you're a superstar blues guitarist, but you're just a regular guy. I mean, you know, you tend to put them up on the pedestal.
Yes. Yeah, I understand that.
And then when his brother opened the door, and my wife was a reporter at the time, so she gave me the press card and I was able to get in. And talking to him, I'd say of all the experiences I've had in music, it's sitting down and talking to him and just knowing his love for music. He was a guy that hated playing a big concert arena. He loved playing places like Toads or
something. Intimate place.
Whether it be 500 to 1,000 people.
And they could be a part of it, be a part of that experience.
Yeah,
that...
and I mean, you know, this is not a story about me, but it's a story about Rory Gallagher. When they were touring in France, they pulled into this town for a gig, and their French agent had got the dates mixed up. They were there a week early. So they were traveling around looking for somewhere, you know, to stay, and their driver saw this... Battle of the Bands in the local high school. And Rory said, okay. Up he goes, and he goes in, and he played 2 free concerts.
Wow. Tony Henry, it's been a pleasure and an honor to talk to you today and learning more about you and your history of WAPJ here in Nutmeg Chatter.
Oh, it's great. I really want a copy of this program if you can get it.
You'll absolutely get that. You'll absolutely get it. Thank you for coming in and talking to us today.
It's my pleasure.
Nutmeg Chatter is a production of WAPJ, Torrington Community Radio. Some of the music has been provided by the Jingle Punks, courtesy of YouTube Royalty Free Music, so we thank them for that. Please stay tuned for more information on WAPJ, Torrington Community Radio. We hope you enjoyed the chat.